One of the most important things that goes along with this that our party has been stressing, it's in our draft program, which we're moving to finalize, is the importance of dissent in socialist society. And as we've emphasized, it's not just a matter of allowing or tolerating dissent, but it's a matter of encouraging and fostering the atmosphere in which dissent can come forward, including protests and demonstrations against government policies at any given time. Mao pointed out, and this was a very important point he made, that in socialist society, even though and even when the government actually represents the interests of the people, of their great majority, in an overall sense, there are still, as he put it, contradictions between the people and the government. And this is a very important thing he pointed out and a very important thing to recognize. Because while you're trying to move forward to continue the revolutionization of society and uproot and eliminate oppression and exploitation, even that process can come into conflict with the rights and needs of individuals or groups in society. And that has to be taken into account and allowed for, and protections have to be provided in laws and constitutions in socialist society which actually protect these rights of the people. Even some of the things that are in the bourgeois Bill of Rights in this constitution in a transformed way and in a very different context need to be put forward and upheld in socialist society. The basic rights of the people to speak out, to assemble, to dissent, to disagree with government policy, to make their disagreements known. And even things like the media have to be made available to broad masses of people, including people who want to criticize and dissent. And if this is not part of what you're doing, then your society is going to be turned back to the old way and eventually back to capitalism. In something I wrote for our paper, The Revolutionary Worker, I pose this example. Many of you know about, I'm sure most of you do, know about Amy Goodman, whose program is Democracy Now! One of the slogans that she uses in her program is the objection to the rulers. So I pose the question in this article, well, we support that. We think she does many good things, even though we have some significant disagreements with her. But what about when, quote unquote, we're the rulers? Then what should we do? And what I said was we should fund things like this. We should give them money. We should give them resources without giving them orders. We should let them raise their criticism, put forward their perspectives, because this is the way the masses of people are going to be able to thrash out things and come to the truth of things and know the world more deeply and be able to transform it more fully. And we're not always right. Even if you have a fundamental sense of where things need to go, you are not always right. And it's very important to recognize that. And also, even if you're not necessarily wrong, there may be things that you're not seeing if you're trying to lead a whole revolutionary process. Because at any given time, whether it's in a new society or even now, there are things that of necessity you have to focus your attention on. Things that you can't pay attention to. Or even if you do pay attention to them, you're not able to correctly understand them. And if you don't allow, but not only allow, encourage and foster and create a favorable atmosphere for people to disagree and struggle and popularize and even be able to put forward through the media opposing views, then you're not going to learn, the people aren't going to learn, and the process is going to grind to a halt and go into reverse. And in this connection, I want to talk about a point that I call the solid core and John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill was a bourgeois theoretician. He wrote things like On Liberalism and so on, where he made arguments about, on liberty, and he made arguments about the needs and rights of people. He was talking about capitalist society. Now, John Stuart Mill, much as he made arguments about justice and liberty, was also a major official of British colonialism. Major official of the East India Company, which was responsible for terrible atrocities in large parts of the world. And he explicitly said that his arguments about the rights of the people didn't apply to countries and peoples that weren't mature yet and who should therefore be colonialized until they were brought up under the tutelage of the more advanced countries. Sound familiar? But nonetheless, there's a point of his that I think it's important not to dismiss. He made this argument that it is not enough for people to hear arguments characterized by those who disagree with them. It is important that people hear the arguments of people who ardently and fervently believe in them, and who therefore can make the best case for them. And I think there's something very important in this, including in socialist society. This is one of the reasons why, now don't get me wrong, we're not going to let the reactionaries run wild. They've had their day, and they've had more than equal time, and their day is coming to an end. But one of the reasons why I say we should even let a few reactionaries publish books in socialist society is because we'll learn things as a result, and people beyond just the leading core will learn things. In the face of this whole, you know, barrage of the death of communism and all that, I wrote a book called Phony Communism's Dead, Long Live Real Communism. Part of that, I polemicized against something that was written by Zbigniew Brzezinski. His comment about how in the Soviet Union, part of the problem of the Communist Party was that there was a whole tradition of authoritarianism deeply embedded in Russian society from the czars and all that. And this worked its way into the Communist Party. When I wrote that book, I refuted that by saying, look, the Russian Revolution was the negation of absolute monarchical rule, czarist rule, as well as bourgeois rule. So nice try, but not right. Then I went back, and over a couple of years, I thought about this, and I thought, you know, that answer is not completely satisfactory. He does have a tenth of a point. There is something he's getting at, and we should go back and look at it. And so I wrote something more recently called Getting Over the Two Great Humps, where I went back to this question and acknowledged that there was a point there, and we should understand it more fully. Well, I use this to illustrate the fact that even reactionaries can make you think about important things. So while we're not going to let them get out of hand and run rampant, victimize and terrorize the people and drag us back, there is a value to letting some of that come out so that people can learn more. And we should not be afraid of that. We should not be afraid of criticism. Two things should be said about criticism. If the criticism is correct, no matter where it comes from, and no matter how much it's raised in a nasty spirit at times, if it's correct, you should take it up. You can only do better and be strengthened by that. If it's not correct, what do you have to fear from it? You can still look at it to see, even while it's overwhelmingly wrong, there might be something you can learn from in it. And this is the kind of atmosphere we need to create. I even think we need to have, while keeping the core of power, so that we don't lose the whole thing, we need to have even an aspect of contested elections in socialist society, where to a certain degree, not for the government as a whole, but for parts of it, on the local level and even on the level of the country as a whole, you need to have some contested elections within the whole overall framework, because that goes back to John Stuart Mill's point. People in that context, we don't need people with bourgeois careers trying to advance their careers. But for people to put forward different ideas about how the society ought to be, and to have people contesting over those ideas as part of the overall process, can strengthen the kind of things that I'm talking about. And all this can become part of advancing toward the ultimate goal of communism in the world as a whole. So together with the advance of the struggle in socialist society to uproot relations of exploitation and oppression and social inequality, and to aid the revolutionary struggle toward the same fundamental goal throughout the world, it is of decisive importance to continually develop the means and forms through which the masses of people themselves can increasingly assume the responsibility for decision-making and administration of society, moving through and beyond the situation where, of necessity, and especially in the early stages of socialist society, the vanguard party, the leading core, must play a greater role and have a greater influence in all this. This can be achieved only through struggle in society overall and within the vanguard party itself and in the relations between the vanguard and the masses. It is not essentially a matter of power corrupting, and that all people and groups who hold power or who have a greater influence in the exercise of political power decision-making will simply refuse to give up that power or allow it to be distributed more broadly and equally among the masses of people and ultimately among all in society. There are, we should acknowledge, definitely pulls in that direction. But fundamentally, this is a question of what we call line, of what worldview people have, what outlook and methods they apply, how they understand reality, and what needs to be done in order to change the existing reality, or, as some would have it, in order to prevent such change, what goals they are working toward, and what principles and means are consistent with those goals and will lead toward the achievement of those goals. There are many examples throughout history where people, on the basis of their viewpoint, methods, principles, and goals, or once again, as we would say, their line, have sacrificed more narrow personal interests in order to achieve what they consider to be the greater good. And this is certainly no less true, and must be no less true of revolutionaries and in particular communists. Even you can think about bourgeois political figures. Think about Richard Nixon. When the Watergate process unfolded and it was clear that he was going to be forced out of office or impeached, Alexander Haig, an official in his government, actually said, and with many ties to the military, that he wanted to call out the military to surround the White House to prevent Nixon from being forced from office. And Nixon, in an example of imperialist largeness of mind, his dedication beyond his own personal interest to the larger interests of the system that he represented, said no and agreed to resign rather than having things come to that pass, which might have threatened the whole system. Or look at Al Gore. Now, you remember the Michael Moore movie, those of you who've seen it, Fahrenheit 9/11. There's that whole really heavy scene where he's gaveling down one after another members of the black congressional Congress because they can't get one senator to take up their challenge to the vote in Florida. But in a perverse and yet real sense, Al Gore was acting out of imperialist largeness of mind. He was saying this will be destructive to our whole system if now that the Supreme Court has ruled, I do not accept the decision and force others to go along with it. Well, if Richard Nixon and Al Gore can do that from the point of view of the bourgeoisie and imperialists and exploiters and oppressors, certainly communists must be able to and will be able to do that for much greater interests of humanity as a whole. The question, the problem and challenge is how to develop and carry forward the struggle to overcome, step by step and through leaps, especially at decisive points, the fundamental contradictions that make a vanguard party necessary in the first place, and which are the basis on which the difference between the vanguard and the broader masses of people will inevitably exist, unavoidably exist, when capitalism has first been overthrown and the socialist state established. These contradictions are rooted in the very nature of capitalism, with its exploitative and oppressive relations and profound social inequalities, including, once again, that great division between those who do manual work and those who do mental work. These unequal and oppressive conditions and relations and divisions in society have been deeply implanted through thousands of years of human history in which society has been divided into antagonistically, hostilely opposed classes. And they can only be overcome through the continuing revolutionary struggle once capitalism has been overthrown. But the point is this. With the overthrow of capitalist rule and the establishment of rule by the proletariat, led by its vanguard party, with all the contradictions that are very real and definitely are involved in this, the basis exists for the first time in human history to actually uproot and finally abolish this class division, exploitation, and oppression, and the economic, social, political, and ideological conditions that are the basis for this and all the suffering that is bound to go along with this. For all these reasons, and in all these ways, socialism is, for the masses of people, for the great majority of society, a far better, an infinitely better system of social relations and of government than capitalism can ever be. But once again, socialism is not an end in itself. It is the transition to the final goal of communism. And in order to get to communism, it's necessary to get beyond what Marx called the narrow horizon of bourgeois right. What does that mean? It's necessary, he said, to do this in the economic and social relations, in the political institutions and structures of society, and in the thinking of the people. Well, let me give an example of what he means by getting beyond the horizons of bourgeois right. At the present stage of society, there's a tremendous amount of very profound inequality. Social inequalities of all kinds, which I've touched on, between men and women, different nationalities, mental manual labor, and so on. But even the concept of equality itself, and even the practice of equality itself, will always involve some inequality. So it is necessary to get completely beyond where things are measured and conceived in terms of equality and inequality. Because the social inequalities will have been eliminated and you've moved to a whole different place. And along the way, sometimes it is necessary to have inequality in order to move toward the abolition of a greater inequality. For example, all these reactionaries always making this noise about affirmative action. I thought we were for a colorblind society. Everybody should be treated equally. What's this giving advantage to one group over another? Well, when you have a profound inequality in this society that's deeply rooted in hundreds of years of oppression and exploitation, discrimination and segregation, you cannot overcome that. First of all, you can't overcome in this society in any thorough way at all. But you can't even make any steps toward overcoming it if you don't institute certain aspects of inequality. If you don't give people who've been oppressed and exploited and suffered from inequality for generations certain advantages, you cannot overcome that inequality, that greater inequality. So right there, in order to achieve equality, you have to have some inequality. Or let me give another example, which might seem small, but on a daily basis is not so small. An example of how formal equality cannot eliminate inequality. At this program, I believe an announcement was made earlier about bathrooms and where they are and so on and so forth. In approaching these programs, we've had to take into account the fact that there isn't complete equality even when there seems to be equality. For example, if you say we're going to have half the bathrooms for men and half the bathrooms for women, that appears to be equal, but in fact it is not, as especially the women here know very well. And that is why in these programs, wherever we've been able to do that, that our party puts on, we've actually allotted more bathrooms to the women because they need more bathrooms in order to achieve equality on a deeper level or to eliminate inequality on a deeper level. So what we're actually doing there is we're actually seeking to provide according to need and not according to formal equality. Bourgeois right says that, you know, if you do something, you should get equal reward for doing that as anybody else does. For example, you and I have the same job, so we should get the same wage. That's equality on one level. But there's a great inequality in that, or there can be. For example, you're a single mother with three kids. Your wage that you earn, it's the same as mine, is not really equal to mine, because what you have to pay for with that is much greater. So while there's equality on the one hand, there is profound inequality. Or you could even get down a level of two people have the same wage, but they don't do the same quality of work. Yet they receive the same wage. There's equality, yet inequality. In order to get to communism, we need to get beyond that whole framework to where things can be, as the communist slogan says, done on the basis of each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. That requires us to achieve an abundance of production and the ability to distribute among the people, and it requires us to bring about a great revolutionary change in the thinking of the people so that you uproot and transform the idea that what makes things worthwhile in life is to have something more than somebody else has. This is a dominant thinking that's drilled into people here. The way that you establish your worth is by having something that somebody else doesn't have or can't have. And in order to get to communism and be able to implement that program of from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, we not only need to be able to provide according to needs in an abundant way, But we also need to transform the thinking of the people so that everyone contributes whatever they can to society in many different ways and gets back what they actually need to have a decent life and to be able to continue developing materially and intellectually in an all-around way. And this, of course, is a great and profound change. In order to do this at the same time, we have to get beyond where things are produced and distributed as commodities, as things that are bought and sold with money. As long as things are still produced and distributed according to the laws of commodities and with money, there is always the potential for some people to accumulate more money than others and to turn that into a relation of exploitation. And even beyond that, as I was just speaking to, as long as you have to pay money for things, we can never actually supply according to need, because the exchange according to money will get in the way of actually providing people's needs. So this is what Marx was talking about in getting beyond the horizon, the narrow horizon of bourgeois right, both in the property relations, the social relations of society, and in the thinking of the people. And when we reach this great goal of communism throughout the world, because it has to be on a worldwide basis, then there will be no more need for an armed body of people, an army, to defend society from forces hostile to it. This is another expression and illustration of why the achievement of communism must occur on a world scale, and why the revolutionary struggle, even while it largely occurs country by country and not all at once all over the world, is nevertheless fundamentally an international struggle. With the withering away of the state, when we've reached the point where dictatorship of any kind is no longer necessary, then democracy itself will also wither away. What do I mean by that? Some people say, well, isn't democracy the will of the people, so why would that wither away? But if you reach a stage where there is nothing opposite to the will of the people, where people resolving questions and contradictions among themselves by peaceful and not by hostile and violent means has become natural because the social conditions and the ideological conditions have changed in that way, then there's nothing that's opposed to the will of the people, and then the will of the people has no meaning anymore. The will of the people only has meaning as long as there are conditions and forces that could thwart the will of the people, that could subvert the will of the people. But once there are no restraints of that kind, no forces that could do that in society, then the will of the people becomes natural or second nature and loses its meaning in that sense. To cite one important aspect and expression of the withering away of democracy, in a communist society, there will no longer be a need for things like a Bill of Rights, as there still will be under socialism. Because the rights of people in that sense will be so much understood to be a part of the way people relate to each other in society that you will not need to formalize and institutionalize this in laws and constitutions and so on. It will no longer be necessary to have these things in order to prevent some individuals or groups in society from being oppressed by or discriminated against by others. And there will no longer be a need for an apparatus to enforce laws that prevent this exploitation and oppression. There will no longer be a need for police or courts and prisons and all the rest of it. Such things, if they still existed, would be a sign of antagonistic or potentially antagonistic relations and conflicts in society, and they would actually stand to the full expression of free association among the people who make up society all over the world. So it is in that sense that democracy will wither away, that these things will no longer have a need and therefore no longer have a basis. This withering away of democracy does not mean that democracy among the people continually diminishes, gets less and less in socialist society under the dictatorship of the proletariat, that there is less and less democracy for the people until finally somehow there is no democracy left at all. In effect, the process is the opposite of that. It is a matter of restricting and finally overcoming the basis on which some people and some parts of society have more political power than others, and play a greater role in determining the direction of society. And once that's achieved, then dictatorship will wither away, and so too will democracy in that sense. At the same time, a crucial part of advancing toward the point where the state is no longer necessary and dictatorships of all kinds can be abolished and wither away, a crucial part of getting to that point is to continually expand and deepen the means, both institutional structures and processes and forms of mass expression and conscious initiative through which ever-increasing numbers of people and ultimately all of society can take part in an informed and conscious way in running the affairs of society and determining the direction of society. Through all this, and in most fundamental terms, the waging of this as a global struggle, a world will finally be brought into being in which neither dictatorship nor democracy will have meaning. A world where humanity will have moved beyond the need or basis for either. A world of freely associating human beings. A true global community where people will unite for common aims while continuing to struggle with each other over the direction forward. They will develop cooperative and collective means for achieving these ends, while at the same time there will be a great diversity and ever-increasing scope for individuality and individual initiative within the overall cooperative framework. This, in other words, is a communist world. In moving to a conclusion, I want to come back to the question of what is to be done now from the perspective of all this. The dividing line today in terms of building mass struggle against this system and its unending injustices and outrages is not whether people are for revolution or against revolution at this point. And it is not whether people will be voting or refusing to vote. The crucial dividing line and challenge now is building resistance to this whole juggernaut of war and repression, as well as other injustices and outrages that this system continually gives rise to. What we must set out to do while we continue to struggle over differences is to unite people as broadly as possible to transform the whole political terrain and the political terms of things in society, rupturing out of the whole framework where the only possible discussion of issues and resolutions of issues is reduced to voting for one or another group of exploiters and oppressors and their representatives. We need to pose the question to ourselves and to people very urgently, because the stakes are urgent. What do we want things to look like when the dust settles around this whole election going on now? What do we want things to look like the day after the election, to put it that way? Do we want people to have become convinced that all hopes ride on electing a Democrat? And if that doesn't happen, we've been defeated. And not only have we been defeated, but we're demoralized because we bought the idea that elections express the will of the people. And therefore, in re-electing Bush or putting Kerry in, and he does what he does, the people have spoken. So what can we do to resist it? As opposed to that, what we need to come out of this whole round of things, beginning with now, there's been a call by Not In Our Name and other organizations to mobilize more than 1 million people to come to New York in a month's time for the Republican National Convention to loudly and in a way that cannot be ignored or covered over, declare no to this whole program. Whether people vote or don't vote, that is a tremendously important thing that people must participate in and be mobilized around, so that whoever wins the election, or even if there's no election, it will have been very clearly and broadly and powerfully demonstrated that there is no mandate for this direction and program, that there is a powerful force in society that is prepared to carry through the struggle against this, even under new conditions of heightened repression, where we may have to develop new forms of organizing ourselves to be able to politically mobilize. Which do we want to come out of the day after the election? Where do we want things to be when the dust settles? To a large degree, this is up to us and how we resolve some of the key questions I've been speaking to here. Again, it's a matter of their dynamic versus our dynamic. The dynamic that we have to set in motion of mobilizing people so that whatever happens through this course of this electoral process or non-election, we are further ahead in mobilizing people to take on and defeat this whole direction. The political establishment, the media, the powers that be in general will insist that the key question is and can only be the election and voting for either Bush or Kerry. And in particular, we should understand the Democratic Party leaders and party hacks will insist that building truly massive and powerful resistance will in fact only provoke more actual and potential Bush voters to come out and vote for Bush and to mobilize other people to do so. And therefore, there should not be this massive resistance. This is a logic they will try to chain people with. This must be actively, vigorously, deeply, and all-sidedly combated as a key part of winning as many people as possible to join and strengthen the crucial movement of resistance, consisting of millions and millions of people, many of whom will vote, as well as many others who will not. And the last point I want to speak to here is the relation between the struggle now and the revolutionary goal as I've laid it out. One of these right-wing groups tied to the Republican Party attacked me for, among other things, being the author of the following, which is part of the three main points that appears in every issue of our weekly newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker. As I said, the whole system we now live under is based on exploitation here and all over the world. It is completely worthless, and no basic change for the better can come about until this system is overthrown. This is a statement for which they have attacked me. Well, let me say first that I will readily and proudly stand up for that statement and everything it embodies, because it is true. And because it is crucial that this truth be put forward broadly and boldly. And while clearly recognizing that especially in the circumstances we are now facing, attacks like this must be taken very seriously indeed, and must be effectively answered and turned back against the attackers. In a strategic sense, I am glad to be attacked in this way by these kinds of forces. To paraphrase Mao, this kind of attack shows that this statement from the three main points in our newspaper has hit upon a profound reality and fundamental truth that these reactionaries do not want brought to light. But the fact that this statement is true, that no basic change for the better can come about until this system is overthrown, does not mean that there is no use and nothing can be achieved in building resistance to this system now and in fighting against particular outrages and injustices of this system. On the contrary, it is crucial to build such resistance as powerfully as possible, especially around the major ways in which this system and those who rule it are moving to attack and oppress masses of people here and throughout the world. What a recognition of the truth of this statement should lead to is an understanding of the need to build all resistance to this system with a revolutionary goal clearly in mind and in a way that builds toward and advances things as far as possible, as fast as possible, toward the goal of revolution. And in this context, before ending, I want to speak to a controversy which has arisen within the broad movement of opposition to the imperialist wars of this system, and in particular the war against Iraq. This controversy centers around the slogan, support the troops, and whether or not it is correct to raise this as part of opposition to the wars in which these troops are involved. I want to speak to the importance of this and the political and ideological struggle around it, both in relation to more immediate objectives, that is, opposing the continuing occupation of Iraq, as well as the imperial wars of this system overall, but also in terms of the strategic perspective of making revolution. The slogan has often been raised in and around the war movement of opposition to wars like Iraq, that we should support the troops, not the war. What about this? No. To give an extreme example, and to pose very sharply what is wrong with this, what if we were to raise a slogan in the context of a rape, support the rapist, not the rape? Whether you support someone or don't support them depends on the content of what they are doing. As long as they are a part of the U.S. Armed Force and acting as the instrument of the system that that armed force is the expression of, they cannot be supported in that context and in that way. We can encourage and should and must encourage them to resist, to rebel, to act out of conscience in refusing to carry out crimes against humanity, and we should build massive support wherever and whenever soldiers do that. And we should popularize examples from the Vietnam War and similar situations where that has been done. But you cannot support the troops without supporting what it is that they are doing right now. Just as you cannot support a rapist without supporting the rape, which is exactly what these armed forces of the U.S. are carrying out literally as well as metaphorically in Iraq right now. To get clarity on this, let's understand that these are the armed forces of a system of worldwide exploitation and plunder. They do not fight for their country, except in the sense that, quote-unquote, their country means this system and its ruling class of capitalist imperialists. Their purpose is not to protect us, the people, but to protect and extend the domination of this system and the class of exploiters and oppressors who rule in this system. Nor do they fight for the rights and freedom of the people. Really, think about it. How many within the U.S. armed forces say to themselves, as they are going off to the theaters of war, or as they are about to enter battle, I am doing this so that these fucking hippies and other protesters can have the right to demonstrate against what I am doing. Come on. Come on now. And despite what they are conditioned to fall back on, when the reality of what they are doing begins to rip through the lies with which they are indoctrinated, these troops are not fighting for their buddies, including those who have been wounded in battle or killed. What and whom you fight for is an objective thing, not a subjective matter of what anyone thinks they might be fighting for. We can use an analogy here to help clarify this. A lot of times you'll hear these Southerners say, the Confederate flag is not a symbol of oppression. It's just a symbol of a way of life. Well, the problem for them is those two things are inseparable. The way of life of which it is a symbol is a way, a system of oppression, of slavery, of brutality, of Ku Klux Klan terror, of lynching. You don't get to choose what something stands for and try to make it be what you want it to be if it has an objective meaning and history in the world. And the Confederate flag does. It was raised once again, even after the defeat of the Confederacy, directly in opposition to the civil rights movement and struggle. That is the objective meaning of that flag. What is this way of life you're talking about? There is no other way of life associated with the Confederate flag than slavery and oppression. Well, similarly, if you're a soldier in the U.S. Armed Forces, you don't get to make up what it is you're fighting about. You may delude yourself as to what you think you're fighting about. Just imagine, to get at the reality that these troops organize themselves to go to Afghanistan or Iraq. Were they sitting around one day hoisting some brewskis? And they said, hey, let's get a map and, oh, Afghanistan, let's go over there and fight a war. Or maybe Greenland, maybe we can fight somebody to fight over there. You all know this is not the way it happens. These troops are organized, indoctrinated, trained, and led to carry out conquest, plunder, and domination that serves the global exploitation and oppression on which this system of imperialism is based and without which it could not exist. And we've seen this, the nature of what they do and what it turns them into when they do it in the Iraq prison scandal. And the same thing is going on in Afghanistan. The same thing, by the way, is going on in prisons in the U.S. all the time. This is a society and system they are fighting for. And beyond that, and beyond the rape that's directly carried out by these soldiers, in one place after another, wherever the U.S. military is stationed, it immediately becomes ringed with houses of prostitution and thousands of women who out of poverty are forced to quote-unquote service these servicemen. This is the nature of the system that this military is fighting to defend and extend and protect. And this is what this military does around the world as a result of that. So who then are the good guys and the bad guys in the world? Confronting these troops with this fundamental truth is an absolute necessity. It's not that we're writing them off or don't seek to win them over, but it's necessary to create a situation in which very broadly they do not have and are increasingly aware that they do not have the support of the people for what they are doing. This was a tremendous thing that happened during the Vietnam War, a mass phenomenon of soldiers turning against their officers and against the system. Even John Kerry got caught up in it at the time. Dewey Canyon 3, thousands of soldiers went to Washington, D.C., took off their medals and threw them away and turned their back on everything that represented. It was a tremendously inspiring and powerful moment. Hundreds of coffee houses and newspapers were developed in or near bases in Germany as well as in the U.S. and other places where soldiers would come and learn the truth about the war and begin to organize protests and rebellion against it. This is the phenomenon we need now and looking to a revolutionary perspective. So in concluding then, while emphasizing the importance of uniting people broadly and building a resistance of masses of millions of people with diverse opinions and positions, some of whom vote and some of whom don't, but all who recognize the crucial importance of building this resistance to a whole nother level and carrying on the struggle beyond these immediate terms. With that in mind, let me conclude by repeating the first and then also include the rest of the three main points that appear in our newspaper. The whole system we now live under is based on exploitation, here and all over the world. It is completely worthless, and no basic change for the better can come about until this system is overthrown. Many different groups will protest and rebel against this system and the things it does. And these protests and rebellions should be supported and strengthened. Yet it is only those with nothing to lose but their chains who can be the backbone of a struggle to actually overthrow this system and create a new system that will put an end to exploitation and help pave the way for a whole new world. Such a revolutionary struggle is possible. There is a political party that can lead such a struggle, a political party that speaks and acts for those with nothing to lose but their chains, the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. This party has the vision, the program, the leadership, and the organizational principles to unite those who must be united and enable them to do what must be done. There is a challenge for all those who would like to see such a revolution, those with a burning desire to see a drastic change for the better, all those who dare to dream and to act to bring about a completely new and better world. Support this party. Join this party. Spread its message and its organized strength. And prepare the ground for a revolutionary rising that has a solid basis and a real chance of winning. We don't have to live this way in a world like this. Another world is possible. Despite the difficult and painful pangs of birth, a better world is in birth. Let's do everything we can to hasten this new world into being. Democracy, humanity can and will do much better, soar much higher than that.